You know, it's hard to believe that it's been 150 years since Charles Darwin first proposed the famous theory of evolution in his path-breaking book, Origin of Species. And the scientific community this year is celebrating that fact. So once again, it is the 150th anniversary of evolutionary theory, and next year marks the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. And if you were to list on a sheet of paper perhaps the most influential theories of all time, theories which gave us the deepest insight into the nature of the universe and life, you would come down with just a handful of ideas. One would be the quantum theory, which gives us atomic physics and in turn gives us laser beams and computers and x-rays and radar and all the gizmos and gadgets of the modern electronic era. Second, you would have to write down relativity theory, which gives us the creation of the universe, the Big Bang theory and black holes. And the other great theory would be the theory of evolution. And after 150 years, you'd think that people would get used to it. But oh no, it turns out that evolutionary theory is just as controversial today as it was 150 years ago. And in fact, polls consistently show this. In fact, a recent poll taken in England, where evolutionary theory was actually born, shows that about 40% of the British public still has qualms about evolution, mainly because it violates their religious beliefs. And today we're going to rebroadcast two interviews concerning evolution. The first special guest today is Professor Mark Hauser of Harvard University, and he has a book with a very outrageous title, and that is Moral Minds, How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong. So he has laid down the gauntlet. Professor Hauser says flatly that religion or religious beliefs are in some sense a byproduct of natural causes, in other words, evolutionary theory. And then in the second half of exploration, we're going to bring on David Sloan Wilson, a professor at Binghamton University in New York, and he's written a book called Evolution for Everyone, explaining how evolution is not an abstract theory, but it affects everything we see around us. So once again, we're going to be running a rebroadcast of two previous interviews that we've had on exploration. Mark Hauser's book, Moral Minds, How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong, in the first half of exploration. And in the second half, Dr. David Sloan Wilson, author of the book, Evolution for Everyone. Well, you know, even though people who are fundamentalists and adhere to every single letter of the good book, even though they disagree with evolutionary theory, evolution has a way, in fact, to explain why all of us have a bias toward religion. In fact, if you were a Martian arriving on the planet Earth, you would say that, well, humans seem to be genetically hardwired to be religious, because all groups of individuals on the planet Earth eventually discover religion on their own. And some people think it goes back to our days in the forest when we were monkeys. Gradually, over millions of years, a band of apes gradually became more intelligent. But you know, intelligence is divisive. As soon as you have people who are intelligent, what happens? You have an argument. Well, what holds animals together is the alpha male, sheer force holds animals together. But as humans become more intelligent, force was unable to hold the tribe together. You needed something more than the alpha male. You needed a mythology to shut off the rational mind, because otherwise the tribe would fall apart. So in other words, you need religion to check the excesses of intelligence. So in some sense, the God gene is, according to the theory, the price we pay for intelligence. Intelligence is divisive. You can bicker and argue and the tribe falls apart and everyone dies. In order to hold the tribe together, you need a mythology. So even though the alpha male is no longer so strong or so intelligent, people still follow the alpha male because he's the son of the alpha male in the sky, and that is God. We'll be right back. And now I'd like to bring on our special guest today. He's Dr. Mark Hauser, Professor of Psychology, Organismic and Evolutionary Biology, and Biological Anthropology at Harvard University. And he's the author of a very controversial book called Moral Minds, How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong. Well, for centuries, of course, people have asked the question, where does morality come from? Where do our ethics come from? We have the Golden Rule, we have the Ten Commandments, but the question is, are they universal? Are they simply instilled into us by Sunday school and religion? Are they taught to us by our parents, or is it hardwired into our brain? Well, Dr. Hauser was inspired by the work of Noam Chomsky, who said that the basic rules of grammar and language are in fact hardwired by evolution into our brains, and he now has a new book with rather voluminous information which seems to indicate that our morals, our ethics, are in fact due to a universal biological grammar, a moral grammar that is hardwired into us by evolution. And so once again, this book is bound to raise certain controversies. The book is called Moral Minds. Okay, let me try to summarize your thesis, and then I want you to elaborate.
Okay.
What you're essentially saying, as I understand, is that we are endowed at birth with a universal moral grammar, not the specific sentences and words and punctuation, but the general moral principles, and they are universal throughout the human race, and we're basically born with them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's just about right. So, but the universal moral grammar, I mean, just like the universal grammar is the theory about the principles, as in a simple way of thinking about it, it's the toolkit for building possible moral systems.
Okay, well, let's get right into proofs or evidence for your theory. Some people will say, bah, humbug, we have to be taught. We have to have religion, we have to have Sunday school, we have to have parenting, or else we'll wind up as thieves and pirates and criminals.
Right.
But what are the tests, specifically tests on children, that have been done at many universities?
Okay, so I think the first thing to really make clear is that this is a theory or an idea about how people judge moral dilemmas. As contrasted with what people actually would do in a particular moral context. And that's an extremely important distinction to keep in mind throughout our conversation here, because what people will actually do in a moral context is probably, at this point in time at least, outside the reach of scientific exploration, in part because so much enters into what we actually do in a given situation. So, you know, as a simple example that probably most listeners will have experienced, sometimes you walk by a homeless person on the street and you reach into your pocket and you pull out, you know, a dollar or whatever it is, and you hand it to the person. And oftentimes you walk right by, but you're not giving this extraordinary amount of thought. You just kind of respond to it in a, you know, positive way in one case and not another. And so that's extremely variable and much enters into what we actually do. I'm in a bad mood. I'm in a rush. You know, today I'm feeling generous. I've got money in my pocket. Way too many variables for science to track in one sense. But where we've kind of made progress, I believe, is in asking people about what they would do or what they think is a permissible thing to do outside the immediacy of the context. And so there have been a couple of approaches that we've taken and others have taken as well. One, as you mentioned, is to begin doing work on early child development to see if some of the distinctions that adults seem to be making in moral context are also things that are driving children's early distinctions. The reason why this is important is because much of the early work on moral psychology and moral development that was pioneered by the late Jean Piaget, one of the really, you know, significant figures in the history of child development, and then basically a predecessor, a successor of Piaget's, Larry Kohlberg, argued that up until the age of about 8 or 9, children only pay attention to the consequences of actions as opposed to the means that underlie those actions. So here's a simple example. Below the age of 8 or 9 years old, if somebody hits somebody else and makes them cry versus somebody slips and hits a person and makes them cry, for that young child, because the person was injured, harmed, they are equally kind of bad or equally responsible. It's not so PhD and Culver claim, until about 8 or 9, that children realize there's a distinction between an intended action and a merely accidental one. Now, that's a very strong claim, and of course, it has a very important role to play in things like witnesses in children. Whether they, if they're only paying attention to consequences, then those means are irrelevant. And so we began to look, and we've started, really only just started this work, but other people have looked at it as well, showing quite convincingly now that if you do the right tasks and you don't look at simply how children justify their answers linguistically, children are very sensitive to the intentions of an agent, of an individual, way before the age of 8 or 9, much more like the age of 3 to 4. So early work now on child development is beginning to show that some of the crucial distinctions that enter into our moral evaluations, like was it intended, was it foreseen, was it an action, or was it an omission, seem to have signatures of those capacities early in development, far earlier than Piaget and Kohlberg would have claimed.
Now, what about the concept of sharing? It's sometimes said that children view the world through a mirror, that is, they can only see themselves and their own gain, and when they get older, it becomes a window, so they can see the intentions of others, mm-hmm. and they have a much larger world outlook. So at what age do children begin to see the benefits of sharing, even though it means they may have, less food or less money of their own?
Mm-hmm. So, here again, this is where, the distinction between what children do and how they judge, gives you, in some sense, some different kinds of things. Let me pose an interesting game that behavioral economists have used now for years to look at the nature of people's basically bargaining capacities. And the game is called the ultimatum game. And there's two players. And typically, the way it's played is you have two people who know all the rules, but it's going to be a one-shot game, and they don't know each other, and nor will they ever meet each other. So one person's the donor, the other person's the receiver. The donor is given $10, and the donor is told, you can make an offer of some proportion of this money to the receiver. If the receiver accepts your offer, then the receiver gets what was offered, and the donor gets what's left over. If the receiver rejects the offer, then neither the donor or the receiver get any money. All right. Now, if you think about the logic of that game, and if you think about it from the perspective of an economist, an economic theory that focuses on sort of rational self-interest models of bargaining, the prediction should be the following. Receivers should accept anything because, of course, something is better than nothing. Donors, knowing that, should give the smallest amount possible because then they maximize their own returns and they've given something to the receiver. It turns out that, at least in the West, when this is played in places like the United States and in England and France and so forth, the typical offer by the donor is about 50%, way beyond the smallest amount. And importantly, receivers reject about a 25 or 20% offer. So they would reject, $2 or $3. Even though it's free. Now, this is, of course, a puzzle for economists, but one of the questions that we can ask, and this is basically going at the question you asked me about fairness and sharing, is what would children do, right? One view is that children are simply just, selfish, and they're just going to take the biggest pot, so they'll offer nothing. But it turns out that children from a fairly young age offer exactly like adults do. They're playing the game as do adults. They offer a significant portion, somewhere in the range of 40 to 60%, and they'll often reject the small offer. So here you have, again, a kind of an early signature of an awareness of what counts as kind of a fair offer in this kind of context for bargaining, and that leads to a common pattern. But, here's the crucial but, we also know that children for quite a long time have great difficulty seeing future gains when current but smaller immediate gains are available. So there's this beautiful study that was done, started about almost 40 years ago now, by Walter Mischel, a psychologist at Columbia, who began testing about two-year-old children on the following very simple task. And the experimenter tells the child, you can have this cookie whenever you want, or you can wait until I come back into the room and I'll give you 5 cookies. Now, the interesting thing about this experiment is that the experimenter never said when he or she would be coming back into the room, simply when they come back. Now, of course, the child's going to take the one cookie at some point in time. The interesting piece of data, the interesting evidence, is how long do they wait? Now, here's the sort of spectacular result. You track these kids until they're basically adults. Children who wait longer at the age of 2 have higher SAT scores. They also have higher marital stability. Children who wait less long are much more likely to have problems of juvenile delinquency. And for women who in their adult years have eating disorders like bulimia or anorexia, those who wait longer are the anorexics, and those who wait less are the bulimics. So here you have a single dimension, time spent waiting, that predicts an immense set of aspects or features of our later personality, almost immune to certain kind of cross-cultural or cultural variations that might happen to us as individuals. Now, that's important because things like sharing and fairness involve at some level inhibiting or self-control of our own self-desires. These things are individually variable, and they carry through much of our adult life.
Now, the whole question is there a set point, a genetic set point, like a thermometer, for delayed gratification? Now, in genetic studies of twins separated at birth, psychologists say that they can find evidence for a thrill-seeking gene, a gene that's very impulsive and seeks out thrills and kicks. There seems to be a genetic predisposition for this in certain twins. And therefore, do you think there is a genetic set point for delayed gratification or not?
I mean, my guess is that we'll find something like that. I mean, nobody has isolated that yet. There's certainly consistent neurobiological or brain data suggesting kind of correlations between things like IQ and the volume of the frontal lobes. So my guess is it's just a matter of time before people begin to isolate the genetics that underlie this capacity. But I would think, you know, that has to be what's going on, in part because we know that things like inhibitory control are mediated by various neurochemicals. We're learning more and more about the genetics underlying those neurochemicals, and the kind of twin studies that you point to are exactly the way to kind of go about figuring that in the case of delayed gratification.
Now let's take a look at evolution. Back in the forest, millions of years ago, you may say that if we are social animals in a tribe, therefore delayed gratification would be a good thing. However, we still seem to have this impulsive behavior with us even today. Just look at the Hollywood movies and TV, especially for teenagers. So why is it that evolution hasn't gotten rid of the impulsive nature and given us all this tremendous delayed gratification?
So I think that the one way to think about it, to me, a useful way, hopefully, is in terms of a term often used in genetics, which is, you know, polymorphism, meaning many possible types, right? And what you have is a situation where, I mean, let's imagine now that we had a homogeneous population of very self-controlled people. And all of a sudden now, there was an opportunity to capture a very large prey item, but that was very dangerous. And one person who is impulsive, happens to be impulsive in this population, all of a sudden just strikes out, kills it, and there we've got an incredible capture of a big prey item. That person gets to eat it. Well, now if there was some genetic predisposition for the impulsivity, there would be high preference for that capacity at some level because of the massive payoff. So I think we can see, in certainly our culture today, you know, those people who get engaged in extreme sports, severe bungee jumping or taking their kayak down a waterfall or, you know, parachuting or whatever it is, the person's going to sit at the edge of the plane going, well, I'm not sure I should jump or not, you know, is not going to get the thrill of victory. There's a lot of publicity for those kind of people. So big advantages in all walks of life. I mean, you know, the great athletes of our time, I think the most creative people of our time are people to some extent who are impulsive in that, maybe that particular walk of life, and that is that they have the capacity to sort of say, look, forget the conservative move. if I just try this, maybe there'll be a big payoff, you know. So I think there's always going to be strong selection going both ways, in that you're never going to have a situation where they're only impulsive people, and you're never going to have a situation, conversely, where you'll have always self-controlled people. So I think that you're going to find a constant balance in the population, and that will never go away.
Okay, now let's also talk about animals, because you mentioned that at the very beginning of the discussion. In wolf populations, for example, there's a very definite social hierarchy. Beta males lower their head to the alpha male, exposing their neck, which is the most vulnerable part of their anatomy, to show deference to the alpha male. And some people see remnants of that in human society as we bow toward our superiors and as we bow to the superior in the sky, God. So do you see analogies, therefore, that even within social interactions with hierarchies, that we see elements of that in the animal kingdom?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think hierarchies are actually, you know, one of the nicest cases of kind of an analogy between certain aspects of human social organization, where you have certain social norms that are at some level implicit rather than kind of written down in explicit kind of document. Animals seem to acquire knowledge of this very early on in development. The rules, so to speak, are quite sophisticated and complicated and can vary actually between fairly closely related species. So, for example, in several monkey species, for example, the vervet monkeys that I worked on when I was living in Kenya, or the macaques, in some of these species, an individual acquires its rank by inheritance. So you acquire the rank of your mother. Now, the interesting thing is that if a mother has multiple females, it's actually the youngest daughter who is the highest rank of all, which, of course, is, you know, extraordinary honk for the older sisters. But the youngest one has the highest rank. Now, the interesting thing is, because in most primate societies, females stay within their natal group throughout their life, they stay within their birth group throughout their life, whereas males leave the birth group once they reach approximately reproductive maturity. You have a situation where when males leave, they lose basically all the benefits they had in their own group. So if they were born to a high-ranking female and now they leave, things will change when they get to the new group. Depending on the species, things can change in a very positive way or in a very negative way. So let me just give two concrete examples. In many baboon species, when you leave, it's the young male who comes into a new group that assumes the top notch alpha male status in that group. In rhesus monkeys, when you leave, if you were a high-ranking male, it doesn't matter. You are now at the bottom of the heap in your new group, and you've basically got to wait your turn until you can climb up the hierarchy. So hierarchies are really a rich playground for certain kinds of social norms about the level of which you have access to certain kinds of resources and the extent to which you don't. I'll just bring up one of my all-time favorite experiments about how hierarchical relationships can change in the face of a skill. So this is an experiment that was done with the macaque species, and the experiment was you take individuals who are the lowest-ranking members of their group, and you train them to press a series of levers or buttons in a sequence to deliver popcorn, which the monkeys in this captive colony like. And they're the only ones who learn this trick. Okay, so once they learn the trick, you release the individual back into their social group, and you put this machine in there. Now, the low-ranking animal goes up, hits the buttons, bop, 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 popcorn comes out. So what happens? The high-ranking animals come over and take the food away. All right, they hit the machine again, bop, 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 popcorn, food goes away. Now, after several experiences like this, the low-ranking animal simply stops pressing. Now, unfortunately, the observer monkeys, the higher-ranking ones, aren't savvy enough to figure out the code. So what they do, spontaneously, without any training or incitement, is they begin being nice to the low-ranking animal. They start grooming that animal. They start not fighting with the animal. But crucially, the subordinate animals now go back to the machine, hit the buttons, and now the high-ranking and low-ranking animals co-feed at that device. Even more interestingly, the low-ranking animal only gets this kind of credit, so to speak, at the device, nowhere else in the society. So here's the way in which it's much more sophisticated than a kind of a simple, well, you're higher ranking than me, and therefore all bets are off for access to resources. No, under certain conditions of skill, low-ranking animals can rise, at least within that context.
Okay, now let's talk about the opposite of morality. Let's talk about immorality. There's a psychologist at the University of Minnesota, I think, Professor Licken, and he has said that in his studies, crime, the violation of social norms, people who are habitual criminals, they tend to be, and I quote, unsocialized, fatherless males. Okay? Now, according to your theory, we're all sort of inborn with this genetic predisposition for certain vague principles, guideline principles, on which a template we then can form specific moral judgments. Now, if that's true, then why should crime be statistically correlated to unsocialized fatherless males?
Well, I mean, I think this brings up, yet again, as I said at the beginning, I think it brings up this distinction between what we do and how we judge. And my guess would be the following. I mean, this would, remain to be seen. But if you took the population of, in some sense, the most immoral people who commit crimes, but you asked them to judge the kinds of moral dilemmas that we have, let's say, on our website, the moral sense test, my guess is they'd give exactly the same judgments as everybody else. Where they differ is in what they do. And the way to make this kind of the most extreme case possible, this is something that's ongoing research right now, is to think about psychopaths, kind of the worst possible case scenario, right? Here are people who do the wrong thing. They kill others. The question is, what's the nature of the deficit? Now, the classic interpretation is these people have an emotional deficit. That is, they lack empathy, they lack guilt, shame, remorse. And because of that, they just don't understand that they're doing something wrong. There's no emotional input, no emotional inspiration.
Well, I'm afraid our time is up for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest for the first part of Exploration is Dr. Mark Hauser. He's a professor at Harvard University, already causing a tremendous amount of controversy with his new book called Moral Minds, How Nature Determines Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong. So when you listen to the presidential debates and each presidential candidate is asked a question like, do you believe in evolution? And they say that they view evolution through the prism of their religion. Just remember that you can turn the tables. You can also say that scientists also look at religion through the lens of evolution. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. And again, it's hard to believe, but it's been 150 years since Darwin first proposed his theory of evolution in the path-breaking book, Origin of Species, and next year marks the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. So in other words, for the world of biology and the life sciences, it's going to be 1 year of celebration because we now have an organizing principle by which we can view all of life on the earth. You know, in many disciplines in science, we have an organizing principle by which we can look at all these random facts. For example, in geology, we have the theory of continental drift and tectonic activity, and that's the organizing principle by which we can look at the continents and the mountains and the ocean beds, and the organizing principle by which we can analyze different kinds of minerals and rocks. In physics, we have two organizing principles, the quantum theory of the very small, which gives us atomic physics and the electronic wonders of today, and the theory of the very big, Einstein's theory of relativity, which in turn gives us the Big Bang theory and black holes and what have you. And of course, in chemistry, we have an organizing principle, the periodic chart, which in turn is a byproduct of quantum physics. By looking at the periodic chart, you can make sense out of all the different kinds of chemicals and elements that we have that make up our known universe. So in other words, in biology, the organizing principle is Darwin's theory of evolution. It allows you to understand the enormous diversity of life forms on the Earth, and it allows you to get a tree of life with DNA analysis, something that did not exist in Charles Darwin's time. We actually have the ability to create, using computers, the tree of life itself. And we humans are nothing but one little branch, one little tiny branch of this gigantic tree that's been evolving for about 3.5 billion years, ever since the first DNA molecule got off the ground. And so it's hard to believe, but a very simple organizing principle, evolution, allows us to explain the enormous diversity of life. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor David Sloan Wilson. He's a professor of biology and anthropology at Binghamton University in New York State. And he's the author of a delightful new book called Evolution for Everyone: How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. Now, when we think about evolution, we think about dinosaurs, or we think about cavemen, and maybe we think about survival of the fittest. But however, if evolution is really true, then it should affect every single aspect of our lives. It should explain how we view beauty, how we view morality, religion, how we view ailments like morning sickness. In fact, there's a whole plethora of phenomena that evolution should be able to interpret. However, of course, there's always the danger of overinterpreting some of these things as well. So once again, our special guest today is Professor David Sloan Wilson, author of the book Evolution for Everyone. The first question for you is, how did you as a youth first get interested in science, and in particular, biology and evolution?
Well, I always loved nature. I always loved to fish and camp and things like that. And as I relate in my book, I'm the son of a famous author, and that made me want to do something respectable, but something that he also couldn't directly compare himself with, and that sort of made me want to become a scientist. And it wasn't until college that I realized that a scientist was not necessarily someone who works in a laboratory and wears a white coat, but that you could actually work outdoors and study animals and plants in their natural environment, just what I love to do, and you could be that kind of scientist.
And why in particular evolution?
Well, evolution, I'm lucky that evolution, when I became a college and a graduate student, that was a time in which evolution and ecology and behavior, the study of all of life really, was sort of becoming integrated with each other. So you can't be a biologist, especially a field biologist, someone who studies whole organisms, without being an evolutionist. That's how much evolution has become a unifying theory.
Okay, well, if evolution is a unifying theory, then it should explain ordinary things as well as spectacular things. So let's talk about some of the things that evolution may or may not explain. For example, morning sickness. Women who become pregnant, many of them start to vomit at the very sight of certain foods, and it was considered a weird peculiarity of pregnancy. But evolutionary biologists are saying that there could be an evolutionary basis to morning sickness. Could you elaborate?
Sure. This is the wonderful work that began with a woman named Margie Proffitt, and I discuss her in my book also. And it's a perfect example of how evolutionary thinking can be used to explain so much. So she was a non-specialist. She was a college, she attended college, and then she just was, an everyday person. But she was starting to think in terms of evolution, and when she started to think about pregnancy sickness, because some of her relatives were pregnant and they were complaining about being ill, she began to think, well, what's this about? How is it possible for women just routinely when they get pregnant to be sick? It's not an infectious disease. What could it be? And so she thought, maybe this is connected to something else, some benefit that we need to discover. And that benefit is that as adults, we eat all sorts of things that have toxins because all of our food has evolved to protect themselves from being eaten. We have ways to detoxify them. But the unborn fetus is not as good at this as the adult. And so what every pregnant woman must do and has evolved to do genetically is to change their eating habits so that they don't poison, basically, their developing offspring, even in the first trimester of pregnancy. And so what was thought to be a sickness turns out to be a part of a very important adaptation that was only discovered on the basis of evolutionary thinking.
And I understand that Japanese women have a very high rate of morning sickness, and Japanese people in turn also eat raw fish. And raw fish, as we all know, can rot easily and also have parasites. So
right.
Perhaps there's a benefit there, huh?
There's quite a lot of cultural variation that you also need to explain on the basis of this theory. But it has become a very well-established concept, and of course it makes a huge difference in terms of medical practice, because if you didn't know this, what you try to do would be to cure women of their disease, and that could be terrible for their unborn offspring. Knowing that it's an adaptation completely changes the way that you think about it.
Now let's talk about the dark side of this evolutionary hypothesis. Let's talk about infanticide and also about fairy tales. Fairy tales, some people think, is a window into the darker side of our subconscious. And fairy tales, of course, are laden with parents, stepfathers, and evil stepmothers. So let's talk about infanticide. Where is it found in the animal kingdom? And where in the human species do we find the largest source of infanticide?
Well, this is an exercise I play with my class when I teach evolution, and I do it at the very beginning when they've only just been introduced to the concept of natural selection. I say infanticide, killing your offspring, would seem to be the very last thing that would evolve by natural selection. Yet with a little thought, you might be able to think of some environmental situations in which infanticide is adaptive. And even knowing so little, even so newly introduced to the topic, they reliably come up with what we can call the big three situations of infanticide, which first is the lack of resources. If you can't support yourself and your existing offspring, then this is no time to have a new offspring. Poor offspring quality, the whole purpose of having offspring is for them to have offspring. And so if for any reason one's offspring is unlikely themselves to survive and reproduce, then that is a context for infanticide. And then finally, lack of parentage, that with some notable exceptions, evolution is about raising your own offspring, not someone else's. And so if there's uncertainty as to whether an offspring is in fact yours, then that becomes another context for infanticide. That explains infanticide across the animal kingdom, and even in plants, by the way, because plants abort their fruits. We don't think of it as infanticide, but it's something that they do. And we have basically a lot of understanding of infanticide in non-human creatures. And for the most part, that also explains infanticide in humans. All of this is not to say that infanticide is inevitable or desirable, by the way. We need a theory to explain these patterns, and then that theory can help us to prevent things that we don't want to occur.
So stepfathers, are they more likely to murder the children if they are not genetically related to them?
Well, it's step-parents. We don't want to leave step-mothers out. And in folklore, of course, the step-mother is at least as conspicuous as the step-father. And so it is a very large risk factor. And, you know, some of these things, we discover them scientifically, but everyone also, in a sense, knows them. And I think if you were to go into the average bar or supermarket and ask anybody, is a child more at risk of abuse from their natural parent or their step-parent? And I think a lot of people would just look at you and ask what planet you came from. I mean, this is not really so surprising that there's a difference between a very powerful psychological difference between how one feels towards one's own children and one's step children. And that's not to say that the vast majority of step parents are very nice to their stepchildren. I had two wonderful step parents. So it's not to say that that conflict is inevitable, but if you look at risk, then surely it's the case that step parents are that's a risk factor.
Yeah. In fact, as an aside, I saw a Nature documentary once where a young male lion comes in and slaughters the old patriarch of the pride. He takes over the pride, and the first thing he does is he slaughters all the pups, all the cubs, because they're not his. And the females, of course, even go along with this because they want to be, you know, on good terms with the new leader of the pride. But anyway, on this Nature documentary, they actually photographed the faces of these cubs right after their father was defeated. And you could see that, in some sense, they knew what was in store for them, that they would be a victim of infanticide.
It's hard to witness, and of course, evolution explains that there's a widespread perception that evolution explains nastiness more than goodness. But the real story is that evolution explains the good, the bad, the beautiful, and the ugly, the full range from the best to the worst.
Okay, now let's talk about beauty. When we talk about beauty, we start to wax ethereal about aesthetics and things. But as far as the animal kingdom and as far as Homo sapiens are concerned, evolution has something very definite to say about what is beautiful and what is not. Could you elaborate?
Well, the evolutionary theory of beauty is that it's an assessment of fitness value, that if anything is likely to enhance your fitness, your survival and reproduction, then you will be drawn towards it, and you will be repelled by anything which is going to be bad for your survival and reproduction. And the way that is subjectively experienced is by feelings of beauty, aesthetic attraction, or disgust. And this theory is so very simple and actually explains, once again, a lot. There's a mix of the new and the obvious here. If you were to look at, for example, humans, what makes a woman beautiful to a man or a man beautiful to a woman, then it's kind of a no-brainer that these are, for the most part, these are excellent indicators of health and fitness in a kind of a physiological sense. But one thing our research shows, this is something that I happen to study myself, is that the value of a social partner is not just based on their physical attributes. It's also based on how nice they are, how intelligent they are. All these non-physical traits are very important for their quality as a social partner. So the real evolutionary theory of beauty is that we should make an overall assessment of how important people are to us, including their non-physical traits, in addition to their physical traits. And it's that we should perceive as physical beauty. That means we should find people physically attractive on the basis of characters which are not physical at all. And that's quite a surprising prediction, which turns out to be largely true.
Now, you talked about supermarket banter the other day. I mean, earlier in the interview.
Yes.
Let's talk about Anna Nicole Smith, which has been dominating the news. Here we have a May-December marriage.
Yes.
Could you explain a May-December marriage in light of evolutionary biology?
Well, that's the easy part to explain. Evolution explains the vulgar very easily. Excuse me for calling that vulgar, but many people do, right? And so, if you think this is back to purely physical sort of survival and reproduction, basically there's something called reproductive value, which is how many offspring are left remaining in an individual. And those curves look very different for women and men, because women's reproduction is very much tied to their physiology. They're the ones that actually have the baby. Then young women are at a peak of reproductive value. But for men, their reproductive value is based in large part on their wealth, because they can fertilize women up until an advanced age. That means that an 80-year-old guy with a lot of money and nothing else can still be a good catch for a woman. And a young, beautiful, fertile woman can be a good catch for the 80-year-old guy. So I say they're made for each other.
Okay, well, evolutionary psychology gets even deeper and more controversial. When we look at a woman's face, people say that a slim chin, large eyes, and clear complexion and full lips are beautiful. And some people say that these are estrogen markers. That is, the amount of estrogen flowing in their bloodstream cannot be measured by a male suitor on a date. But a male suitor can simply rapidly scan the size of the eyes, the shape of the chin, and the fullness of the lips to calculate how much estrogen is floating in her bloodstream. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that the most interesting thing to say about that is that you get to a level of detail where it could turn out either way. And some of these predictions end up being correct, and others end up being incorrect. Another example of this is the waist-hip ratio. That's an indicator of fecundity. And that hypothesis, it makes great sense. You know, this logic is perfectly easy for us to understand, but it's not obvious that it's true. And in that case, I think that the evidence is starting to weigh against it, that it's not culturally universal that men around the world value the same waist-hip ratio and so on and so forth. So a particular hypothesis, such as the fullness of the lips indicating estrogen, might or might not be true. That can fall either way. The more general hypothesis about beauty as a fitness indicator, I think, has much to recommend it. Although specific proposals might win or lose.
Okay. And also on any dating chart, when people ask what qualities you want in a potential mate, a sense of humor is pretty high up there. However, that sounds counterintuitive. I mean, why should a sense of humor outweigh a person's pocketbook, a person's physical characteristics? On an evolutionary scale, sense of humor seems to rate high, but why?
That's great. A great question, and it does seem paradoxical at first until you realize what a sense of humor means and what laughter means. And here's another case where you can take a subject which is which seems very far removed from evolution, and yet it turns out to really beg an evolutionary explanation. And it turns out that what does it mean to have a sense of humor and to be relaxed and in a good mood? That's the time in which you're not frightened, you're not fearful, and you can actually develop your potential, either your social potential or your personal potential. If you're not in a situation where you can relax like that, then you're uptight. Basically, people have expectancies for you, and you can't really develop as a person. And so it turns out that laughter evolved very early in human evolution. We laughed, almost certainly we're laughing before we were speaking. I think that's a great concept, that we could imagine a period in our evolution where our ancestors were laughing even before they could talk to each other. And the purpose of that laughter was to signal periods in which they could actually not worry about predators, not worrying about where their next mouthful is coming from. And that's the time when they could learn, basically, as individuals and as groups.
Now, let's also talk about intelligence. First of all, why did we become intelligent? And an even more intriguing question, why are we more intelligent than we have to be to survive in the forest? I mean, humans can conceive of starships. We can talk about genesis on a physics framework. We can talk about galaxies, atoms, stars. We can split the atom. We don't need to do that if we simply want to survive in the grasslands of Africa or the forests. So first, why did we become intelligent? And why are we so intelligent that we can contemplate the origin of the universe when that's not necessary to survive in the jungles of Africa?
Well, I would challenge a number of those points that you make. For one thing, there's no such thing as a single kind of intelligence. There's many different mental abilities. And non-human species are vastly superior to us in certain kinds of intelligence. One of my favorite examples is the chickadee. All the people up here know about the chickadee. And it stores seeds and food in thousands of locations in the fall, and then danged if it doesn't remember where they all were over the winter. And I can't find my keys in the morning. So there's examples of animal intelligence which vastly exceed our own. And our intelligence is a very flexible kind of intelligence. And one of the things that that means is that actually we can't survive. If you put me in the woods, I wouldn't survive very long at all. That's how open-ended our instincts are. I think being a hunter-gatherer is probably more challenging than being a physicist or a biologist. Just imagine making a kayak, for example, if you're an Eskimo, and what that might go into. So now it's true that what we do with our intelligence, and we do it in a very collective way. So another point is to make is that this is not an individual property. Einstein or any modern scientific theory is a product of many dozens and hundreds of people accumulating over many generations. So I think that it's not the case that we have some ability that cannot be explained on the basis of helping us survive and reproduce in the ancestral environment. That's just not a puzzle
well,
to me.
Well, whatever you call it, okay, humans are different from the rest of the animal kingdom in our ability to engage in abstract thought. The usual metaphor is you cannot teach calculus to a chimpanzee.
Oh, yes,
or
that's
even
true.
Ask him to count beyond maybe 50 or 100. And so, we can talk about intelligence at length. We've done so on previous with guests on exploration. But whatever you call it, why did we evolve into Homo sapiens, thinking man? And why are we more intelligent than we have to be to survive in the forest?
Right. Well, I think this is also a theme which is a strong theme in my book. What makes us so unique, I believe, is that we are the primate equivalent of a beehive or a single body. What's really special about us is our unique ability to cooperate and trust our social partners. And what that means in the mental realm is that then we could share information and we could evolve symbolic thought, the capacity for symbolic thought, communicating that through language, and then transmitting information through cultural mechanisms. And then what that led to was a situation in which most of what we do is not transmitted through our genes now, it's transmitted through our culture. And I think that is what makes us truly unique, including aspects of our intelligence. But we really needed it to survive in the forest. I still resist the idea that these abilities that have enabled us to split the atom and so on weren't not the very same abilities that enabled us to invade a new climatic zone, for example, and figure out how to make kayaks. I think that I have a feeling that the same mental abilities were at work in both cases.
But again, if you take a bunch of dogs or cats or chimpanzees or any organisms on the planet Earth and ask them to count beyond 100, ask them to manipulate 50,000 words, ask them to manipulate their environment, to reshape their environment according to their own wishes, you'd find degrees, and humans are off scale.
Oh, yes, and I agree with that, and I tried to say that myself. Well, it's because we needed to be in highly cooperative societies for that to get going. And so the watershed event was the capacity to cooperate within groups. That is the general answer. I hope that's clear, but I think that is the beginning of our fabulous mental abilities, was the ability to cooperate within groups.
Well, there are two theories, at least two theories, as to why we are more intelligent than we have to be. The first is the arms race theory, which simply says that we had to compete with other smart animals, that is us.
Right.
And the competition between us created an arms race like the peacock's feathers, like the cheetah and the impala, which are, much, of course, much faster than other organisms and much faster than they have to be. So an arms race, like between Russia and the United States, developed between competitive tribes. And that's why we became more intelligent than we have to be. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, we had two special guests today honoring the 150th anniversary of the theory of evolution, and next year marks the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. The first special guest we had was Professor Mark Hauser of Harvard University, author of a controversial book called Moral Minds: How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong. And that book, of course, is guaranteed to generate a certain amount of controversy, because he's essentially saying that morals, our sense of ethics and right and wrong, come from natural forces like evolution. And then in the second half of Exploration, we brought on our second guest, Dr. David Sloan Wilson, author of the book Evolution for Everyone, teaching us that evolutionary theory is not something that's abstract and dry, but something that affects all of us. Now, I should also point out that my latest book is called Physics of the Impossible, and it's a book that was 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's a book that also tries to unravel some of the secrets of physics. In other words, when you see all these Hollywood blockbusters and you see things like invisibility and teleportation and starships and antimatter engines, is it all a bunch of mumbo jumbo, or does it really make sense from a physics point of view? Well, believe it or not, things like time travel, interdimensional travel, things that seem like really far out are actually physically possible, according to some physicists. So in other words, perhaps one day it may be possible to build a time machine if, of course, you have very advanced technology, far more advanced than anything we have here on the planet Earth. So the book is called Physics of the Impossible, and is guaranteed to unravel some of the most fascinating devices that we see in science fiction and in Hollywood blockbusters, and hopefully make it available to the average person so they can understand where physics ends and where science fiction begins. Well, that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, inviting you to join us every week when we discuss science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.